This podcast is brought to you by Workle, a platform helping people get happier at work. Find out more at workle.co. Work happier.
I would put myself in the accidental entrepreneur camp. You can't have it all, so there are going to be sacrifices. We started with this tiny little thing, no fridge, no kettle, chair, table, and a Mac laptop. Back in the day, we would have done anything and everything. You know, you do have to scrap when you're that size, really.
Welcome to the Happy Work Life Podcast, where people with inspiring careers reflect on how happy they have been in their working lives. On this podcast, we hear from a range of people working in business, startups, science, academia, media, healthcare, fashion, and much more, and find out which roles gave them the most satisfaction and, importantly, what they have done to get happier at work. So, sit down with me, Mark Price, founder of Workle, to help you get happier at work. Workle is the platform where you can find a job in the happiest companies, take our happiness test, network, and get career support from experts, and much, much more. Hello, welcome to this edition of the Happy Work Life podcast, where I'm delighted to be joined by Ben Askins. He's the founder of Gaia, a green technology company. But that isn't the first company that he's been the founder of. He's a serial entrepreneur. And before Gaia, founded Verb, which he'll tell us all about, and successfully sold it. But Ben is also well known for the advice he gives to people about their working lives and careers. He's got a hugely successful YouTube channel, and he's got hundreds of thousands of people that subscribe to his newsletter. So, Ben, it's lovely to have you on the podcast, and it's great to have an entrepreneur, because so many of our listeners think that, you know, they'd love the entrepreneur's life and it must be so exciting. So before we get on to that, was there anything in your early years, in your school years, that made you think that one day you were going to set up businesses?
I wouldn't say so. No, I would put myself in the accidental entrepreneur camp in that sense. I think I had quite a sort of classic growing up. Actually, I grew up in Greece for the first 10 years of my life. So my dad worked in shipping. So I lived out there for the first part of my life and then moved to East Anglia and Suffolk, where I went to school and then eventually went to university and moved to London after that. So there was nothing throughout. I've always quite liked the performative element, which is, I suspect, why I like the social media stuff. There's an element of performance that I perhaps didn't expect in myself. But overall, no, I think it was a real coincidence. I had very, you know, university, I was doing a lot of internships. I had a job all lined up after university. And it was sort of circumstance as much as anything else that ended up where I am, really.
So going back to the younger you at school, were you academic? I mean, what subjects did you like? Sporty?
Very sporty. I've got sort of four of us siblings wise, so it's a very sporty family. It's a lot of tennis and hockey and cricket and rugby and all of that. So incredibly competitive family. My mum especially. And then we have you know, sort of subjects wise, it's quite essay based, I guess. I sort of prefer the histories and the Englishes of the world rather than the more maths and physics. But I wasn't, you know, I was, you know, fine at it. I didn't set the world alight in any sort of academic sense. And I just, you know, I think a lot of stuff that's happened in my career is just because an opportunity came along and I said yes to it. And I often think that's half the fight, as it were. But overall, yeah, no, it was a sort of standard sort of school upbringing in that sense. I did classics at university, so sort of Latin and Greek and ancient history and stuff. I use that all the time, as you can probably imagine. And then was all set to go into shipping insurance, actually underwriting. I had an internship over university, had a job all lined up. And then the company I was due to start with got bought sort of a month before I moved to London. So sort of had a few months sort of trying something else. And then I met my business partner, Chris, who said, I've got this idea. You know, I've started doing this. What do you reckon? And that's what Verb was born, I guess.
Okay, so before we come on to you setting up Verb and the marketing, you went to Warwick University.
Correct.
You studied classics.
Classics with ancient history, yes.
Yeah. I read archaeology and ancient history.
Oh, so there you go.
There you go. Yeah. You can do these degrees and survive. So, did you enjoy the degree?
I loved it. I think it's weird. It's quite trendy to sort of trash university these days. And I can kind of see why, especially in regards to like where the funding goes and everything like that. I think for me, I needed university. I was quite an immature 18-year-old, for want of a better phrase. And I think a lot of, you know, kids, you know, 18, I guess adults, some are adults, some are kids, I think at 18. And I was definitely in the kid camp. So I think for me, there was a maturing required that university massively helped with. I loved my time there. Huge amount of sports, some very close friends who I still have today. You know, was it the most academic 3 years of my life? Probably not. But in regards to what I got out of it, I would absolutely put that in the success column.
And you said you did numerous internships. What did you do?
Yeah, so I did a couple of sort of financial sort of hedge fund internships. I did I was in Lloyd's London for a sort of underwriting company, which I did two or three times. I sort of kept working for them at the holiday. So that was very much the career I was kind of all heading into, sort of shipping and underwriting in the world of sort of brokering.
Sorry to interrupt. Is that because of your dad?
It was definitely how I got the internship. Was my dad knew someone who I sort of went and spent a couple of days with, really liked the team. They said, oh, do you want to come back next holiday? So it very much started in that sense. So yes, in short, sheer nepotism. And then off the back of that, I actually really enjoyed the team. I really liked it. It was something I was sort of quite keen to do. Lloyd's of London's very cool buildings. It was like quite a lot of fun to sort of be working in there. And then, yeah, like I said, it was the sort of circumstance that led to that falling through just before I moved to London.
And if you go into underwriting, what do you have to be good at?
Do you know what? To this day, I'm still not that sure. I think it's a very sort of relationship based element, because it's so mathematical now, in the sense of it's not like gut feel. It used to be sort of back in the day, I think this is a risky investment or not. Now it's very much you're working within sort of margins that you just can't sort of break in any sense. So it's actually much more about the personal relationships of who do you know, do they want to do business with you. So it's a very social, the Friday lunch club and all of that. It's a very social part of the world in that sense. So it's a very sort of personal based business, I would say. It is very interesting as well. So yeah, I had a lot of fun doing it, and I'm sure if I'd gone down that route, I would have had a good time. But yes, fate had another path for me, I guess.
So before we get onto that fate, you left university. What was your first job?
So first job, it was meant to be that, and then I did recruitment for about 3-4 months, just as a sort of something where I'd moved to London and needed a job. My first actual job was working on a farm. So throughout school and university, during the summers, I was the sort of in charge of sort of the local, basically coming in to pick potatoes and onions, and finally got promoted to tractor driving, dinged the very expensive combine harvester, and got put back on the picking line. So that's how that ended up.
And so your first job after university was recruitment.
Was recruitment, yes.
So 3 months. And how was that? What's good and bad about that job?
It's fantastic. I mean, it's a great way to learn how to talk to people, because all you're doing is talking to clients, talking to candidates. You get a real feel for what's happening in the sort of sector that you're in, because, you know, the companies that are hiring and inevitably the ones that are doing a lot there. So I had a great time doing it. Had an amazing business that I worked for, enjoyed it immensely. And probably, again, you know, I'm always someone who sort of looks on the positive side of things. I think I'm pretty good at making the best of a situation where I can. And it was only because of this opportunity with Verb that came up that I sort of left, really.
So tell us about that. So there you are, you're 3 months, well, probably less than 3 months into recruitment. And you decide with a friend to set up Verb. So where did the conversation first start? How did you go about it?
Yeah, so Chris is my business partner, Chris Donnelly, who's very, very successful entrepreneur as well. And he basically, we were at university together at the same time. So we didn't know each other, but we knew people sort of around each other in various circles. Anyway, I met him in London because everyone was doing the same thing, and LinkedIn was getting going. We're all trying to network and feel very important and try and meet as many people as we could. And he sort of said, oh, look, well, I've, you know, at university, Chris started building websites to make a bit of extra money at university, basically. And he basically said, well, look, I really want to sort of, you know, go for it on this and do a proper agency and actually try and grow it. And we want to do this, that and that. And I said, that sounds amazing. And so, yeah, it was in sheer ignorance. We both sort of decided to sign the next 10 years of our life away.
You're sitting together, what, in a pub, in a coffee shop?
It was a Starbucks coffee. And what's funny, and Chris always tells the story, is Chris was meeting two different Bens that day. So the first 10 minutes of our meeting, he thought he was talking to the other Ben. And so it was a real sort of moment. We still have the LinkedIn message we sent each other that kind of led to our first meeting, because he's still one of my very best friends today. And so he said, I'm doing this. I said, that sounds amazing. And he said, well, look, you know, what do you reckon? And I said, absolutely. Having no idea, none of us had marketing backgrounds. None of us knew anything about digital. But an agency as a first business, if you're going to go into it, it's a great one because of the financial model, really.
Yeah, so let's talk about that. I'm assuming that you didn't raise £20 million and take swanky offices in central London.
We absolutely did not. There was nothing swanky about any of our offices. No, we then what's nice about digital agency is it's service based, and what that means is you can bootstrap it. And especially, we knew nothing, but because we're so young, we're basically university students, we're very used to living on the cheap. We didn't need much money, as it were, either. So, not having dependents and things like that obviously made a huge, I have a lot of admiration for entrepreneurs who start it at 30 or 40 or 50 because the stakes were often so much higher. Whereas for us, it was just, what are we going to be more poor than we are currently? It's hardly likely. So, yeah, so we set it up, and we started off by doing a lot of free work for people. Because the first thing you need to do and the first challenge you're ever going to encounter as a business owner like that is, I don't, you've not done it before, you've not got the experience, you're looking aggressively young. We age quite quickly, as entrepreneurs do, but back then we looked quite young. And we ended up basically doing a lot of free work just to kind of build our portfolio. And then we started to tap into bloggers' sites. So we started off with web design and build, and we sort of tapped into like the main Chelsea lot who all had these blogs going and things like that. And then one of our bloggers suddenly started to do exceptionally well. She was called Ella Woodward. We'd built her first blog website. And she who became Deliciously Ella, who's obviously very famous today, but we were her sort of first sort of web design agency. And we sort of caught a bit of a wave of that. And off the back of that, we started to get more sort of paying clients and leverage the existing clients we had to kind of go on to the bigger and better things, really.
And where was your first office?
Our first office was in Shoreditch, sort of East London, and it was a sort of tiny little. It was sort of shared office space, but what it would do is if as you grew, they would sort of knock through various walls, and it was a bit of a jigsaw office. But yeah, we started with this tiny little thing, no fridge, no kettle, chair, table, and a Mac laptop because obviously it had to be a Mac, being the trendy agency that we were.
And did you have that from day one, Ben, or did it take you a little while to get your first office?
Pretty much, we still got an office pretty quickly. There's a little bit of sort of sharing office space here and there, but the reality was like Chris, whilst doing at university, would sort of share office space as well. But once we sort of full time on it in London, yeah, we got an office quite quickly. It was very cheap back then, I have to say. Offices were not the most expensive, especially this office.
And did you need much money to start?
No, not really. We needed a website which we kind of built ourselves. Need a little bit of cow, we paying ourselves very little, if at all, at the start. But we quite quickly like got a little bit in, and then we were able to sort of fund it. So no, we didn't need much money to start going at all. And you really don't. Like the best thing about that type of revenue model is you can win the work, get the money in, and then actually start delivering it. And that's a huge benefit to having to raise loads of capital for whatever reason.
And do you remember who your first paying customer was?
Yes. So Chris, I guess it depends. Chris's first, well, the first one was a fish and chip shop for £300, which is ironic considering like where we ended up. In regards to, like the sort of first meaningful clients, like I remember our first big brand was like Larsen & Jennings, a watch brand, which was very exciting because it was the first time we'd moved away from like blogging websites to like a proper business. So there's a few companies that stick in mind as to when we won them because they felt like moments for sure. But back in the day, we would have done anything and everything you do have to scrap when you're that size, really.
So talk to us about that scrap. Talk to us about those 10 years from, the two of you in a kind of a small office doing free websites, getting the fish and chip shop for 300 quid. Take us all the way through to selling the business 10 years later and how well you did. What do you see as being all those milestones for you?
Yeah, so I think so. We had a third business partner as well, who sort of left halfway through the journey. So kind of Chris started the sort of first. Our first revenue was when Chris was at university, and then we've sort of joined up full time after uni. But essentially, what happened was Chris and I were very good at sales, but we couldn't do the work. And what was quite interesting about that, the con was obviously we always needed a team to kind of do the work, but the main advantage we had was a lot of business people who start their business get lost in actually the delivery of it all. So creative director or head of design or architects is a big one where like the main architect's just always doing the work instead of doing your job as a founder and a business owner, which is focusing on revenue, bringing in the top line and everything like that. So Chris and I were always very good at just focusing on the revenue generation because we couldn't really do the other bits, which was around actually delivering it. So it was slowly about using the current crop of clients to win the next work. Because when we finished, we were working with Amit Omega and Aston Martin and Bugatti and Maybelline Hotel Group and all the sort of top luxury brands. But you don't start there, right? No one, unless you, for whatever reason, get super, super lucky, no one trusts 22-year-olds with those types of brands. So you go through a journey. And I think we're always quite good at sort of recognizing what the next level of client was, winning that, and then slowly sort of building on those blocks, really.
And then talk about building the team.
Yeah, so it's weird because I think the biggest challenge we had was Verb did grow quite quickly. And so what we had was someone who was exceptional team member when the team was, say, five of us, perhaps struggled more when there was a team of 20 of us or 40 of us. And I think the hardest part of growing a business is people who were unbelievably useful, absolute essential to the business become not as important as you grow, and sort of recognizing that and sort of keeping that balance. I think the hardest part was kind of establishing a middle management team. And what I mean by that is when you get sort of 15, 20 people, it feels like the founders have to do everything. They're involved in every client. They're involved in every sales pitch. They're sort of trying to manage everyone. And you need to start to sort of develop leaders within the existing business to actually start taking on more of that management era. The honest truth was it was just a huge, huge trial and error period. And, you know, I think the best type of management, I think I've always been a believer of just recognition of your mistakes you've made in the past. But it was, you know, we made countless mistakes and thankfully just got enough of them right to kind of make the way we did, really.
And did you have any sleepless nights?
For sure. You know, I think one of our biggest learning, we were very naive around cash, for example, early on. I think we never clocked that you could have a profitable business and still run out of cash. But the we were so poor on debt collection and chasing invoices. So there was definitely a couple of times at the start before we'd invested in a finance team where we were just suddenly just had no money in the bank and had payroll the next week and sort of floundering around that. We've had, you know, big sort of like client losses and legal battles over the years, as you do. It's a roller coaster, and I think you just have to recognize the huge perks you get as being an entrepreneur and the absolute not so good bits, I guess you'd say.
So for somebody listening to this, what would you say are the biggest challenges, and then what would you say are the biggest moments of joy?
And the biggest challenges are that you can never quite switch off. And it's an interesting thing to say, especially as, you know, I'm someone who does talk about the importance of switching off and the work-life balance. And I do stand by that. I always do. I always believe that you do need that time to switch off. But the reality is, if you are working, especially in a time-intensive business, which Verb was, you just can't. Like, you can't, you know, you can go on holiday for sure, but you need to be available to check in, do things. You need to, you know, you have to work weekends sometimes. You have to catch up. You have to work late nights. You know, a lot of, you know, Chris and I remember having a very sort of honest conversation where we kind of realized we both lost loads of friends during our 20s, not through sort of falling out, but just because the business sort of became all consuming. And we actually course corrected a little bit. We sort of recognized actually that's not what we want, right? We want to have that sort of slight better balance. And we both have unbelievably patient wives who've kind of put up with a lot over the years. But I think those are definitely the sort of con side. The pros is it's yours, right? So every win is exponentially more joyful because it's directly benefiting you. You care so much more about it. You feel like there's a real sort of every effort that you put in, you're directly benefiting yourself, which is obviously from a selfish perspective, always nice, as opposed to sort of wasted effort. And, you know, there's a freedom to it. There's both a freedom and a sort of not, you know, but it's a different sort of freedom in the sense of you can do what you want. You know, it's your decision really, and the buck stops with you.
And do you have a view on what kind of person, what kind of characteristics are best suited to an entrepreneurial life?
No, I think everyone's different. I think you need to be driven. I think you need to be quite competitive. I do fundamentally believe that because in a lot of ways, in order for you to win, someone needs to lose out if you're sort of operating like a market share industry. So I do think a competitiveness is important. I think there needs to be like a level of delusion as well. I mean that in a positive sense, in the sense, like we spent the first 4 years being really patronized to, like, really everyone's sort of saying, how's your little business going, or how's the, oh, this won't work. And it's amazing how everyone tells you it won't work until it does work, and then they start saying, well, that was just so obvious, you got really lucky, you caught a wave. And I always say, like, that's fine, like, you know, I think that's, and so when I say a level of delusion, you need to really sort of tune out what a lot of people are telling. And the hardest thing is when people you really trust and appreciate and respect are telling you that as well, and they don't do it in a way that's sort of trying to put you down. It's just sort of what people say as you go through this journey. So I think a level of delusion always helps when it comes to entrepreneurs. And then just a willingness to work hard. And, you know, a lot of people ask me, you know, in the age of side hustles, like, what should I be doing? And I always say, like, the first thing is make sure you do something you actually enjoy talking about. Because I think one of the advantages we have in this day and age is you can monetize anything, which means you can monetize hobbies and interests. And if you're going to be doing lots of extra work, you might as well pick something you enjoy talking about.
And we'll go on to talking about work-life balance and the advice that you give people around careers. But if somebody's now thinking, oh, I want to leave my job at HSBC, which is 9 to 5:30, and become an entrepreneur, would you be saying to them, being an entrepreneur is not a 9 to 5:30 job, particularly in the early days?
Not necessarily, because it absolutely can be. There's plenty of examples of 1, 2, 3 people companies who, you know, have a great lifestyle business which has a few hundred thousand pounds profit a year. That's eminently possible to do 9 to 5:30. That's actually, if I'm being very honest, very possible to do Monday to Wednesday. In regards to that, it depends what you want, right? If you want to scale a business to global size, international offices, there are going to be sacrifices, right? That you've got to give up something in return for getting all of that. And that might be in your health, in your exercise. It could be in your sleep. It could be in your family. It could be in your, you can't have it all. Like you can't. So it's not about sort of saying, don't do it, or it's going to be, I just say, look, that be aware that it comes with a cost. And if you're willing to pay that cost, amazing. Go for it. I'm all for it. I love, you know, I'm a huge entrepreneur. I think I always will be. I'm always for businesses. But I like to be sort of realistic in what I say. And so I think that's the sort of main lesson I would give. But the other thing I would say is I would start it while still working. I would try and mitigate the costs, build up a sort of retainer base, get to sort of 2-3 grand a month or something, at least just, you know, whatever it might be, pay for the mortgage and a couple of other bits sort of thing, and then quit your job. And yes, that would involve working the weekends and the evenings. But I would definitely always advise starting it while still working, rather than go all in straight away.
And how many years into Verb did you rub to your hands together with Chris and say, this is good? You know, this is going really well now. How long did it take you to get that feeling?
I think when we started winning our first proper retainers, so we were a web design and build company before we went full service. And I think the problem with web design and build is project-based revenue. And that's great. But what that basically means is you always need to winning more work, and it doesn't give you that confidence to hire people in the long run. Whereas actually what you want is retainers where companies will pay you a certain amount a month to do your digital marketing, your social media, where it's more of like a retainer base. Once we went full service and started to do retainers, I remember getting to, I think it was like £50,000 a month in just retainers. And I think that's when we started to feel like we because I think we were poorer than all of our friends for the first few years, for sure. Like, you know, we went to good university, like a lot of university friends went straight into, like, everyone joined Deloitte, as far as I can work out, or PwC, basically, certainly in our sort of uni lot. And so, you know, people, it felt like we were behind the curve in a lot of ways. And then suddenly we just sort of exponentially overtook, just because, you know, it compounds a little bit. So I would say probably when we're about 25, maybe 26, it's probably about 25 when it really felt that we had something, as it were.
And then talk us through the process of selling. So you built this up, you're hugely successful, you're working with these massive brands. There's you and Chris. How do you start having the conversation that says, oh, I think we should sell it now, we're 10 years in, and go and do something else? How does that work?
Yeah, so Verb had basically reached a size where we either sold it now or we would grow it to like the next level over another 5-10 years. And the honest truth was, Chris and I, we'd gone through COVID as well. It's like the end of 2020, 2021, when we started to have this chat. And we basically said, we kind of both sort of looked at each other and we said, I don't know if I want to grow it any further. Like, I feel like I've got everything out of it. And it's interesting, like a lot of the jobs I'd started to do at Verb at that time, I just felt like I was in second gear on. It was selling luxury digital, and I could do that in my sleep. I'd had so many hundreds of thousands of meetings talking about the exact same thing. And for me, I think a lot of the challenge was kind of wearing off. And I like the challenge. The challenge is kind of, the idea of being excited about a meeting for me is a real testament to whether I'm enjoying my job. And the excitement comes from, I actually don't know where this is going to go. I don't really know what's going to be said. I like to be pushed. I like to be put on the spot. It's just what I find quite motivating. And for me, I was in second gear. I was saying the same thing in every meeting. And it was, you know, it was a polished routine, right? It was a very good routine. It was bringing in a lot of revenue. But we just felt we'd got to the point where actually, you know, we both wanted to push ourselves, we wanted to do other things. And so we started the sort of process of going down the sale route.
So how do you do that? How do you sell a business?
Yeah, so it's an interesting question, because a lot of entrepreneurs say, I want to sell for 10 million, or I want to sell for X, or whatever it might be. And everyone goes, oh, and all I need to do is get to X profit and X multiplier, and that's how you do it. And to an extent, they're right. But the honest truth is, you sell by what someone's willing to pay for it. And so the best thing you can do is to get multiple parties involved. And this is where someone like Chris is actually exceptional at it. But he basically had, we had a couple of, we were kind of at a stage where digital agencies were all trying to do a bit of acquisitions. So everyone, it was quite a trendy thing to do. A lot of big agency groups were taking on funding from private equity to kind of do a sort of M&A spree, and then they would roll up into a big group and float or sell for even more further down the line. So we kind of caught we sort of got the timing quite right there. The other big advantage we have was we were luxury. So we had a very specific niche, and luxury is a weird sector. It's quite a snobby sector, in the sense of luxury doesn't want to work with non-luxury. So a lot of the big agencies could never quite crack luxury because although they work for unbelievably impressive businesses like the Amazons and the, you know, all the big hitters, that's not what Aston Martin want, right? That's not what Amiga want. That's not what the Ritz wants. Like they want, you know, ironically, digital marketing for luxury is quite far behind, say, what Nike do or any of the big other companies. But there's a perception, there's a brand element that you have to consider. And so we started, you know, a lot of agencies were interested. We knew we'd network quite well. And we basically sort of told a few of our mentors that we knew, you know, were interested in selling. And they all sort of went, oh, you know, we're interested in all of that sort of stuff. And so we got sort of two or three provisional offers, and then, you know, picked the one we wanted.
But when you say we got them, did you put an advert in the paper saying we want to sell our business?
No, so it was mostly word of mouth. We didn't have a lot of people will say we want to go out to market and people will do that. Again, like that's just not really, we thought that sounded a little bit desperate in a lot of ways. I think like the best time to sell is when you feel like you're in a position of power. Otherwise, it's a bit of a fire sale. So no, we sort of went out to a few different people and who we knew were interested and started sort of floating the idea. Basically by saying, look, this is what we're being offered. What do you think? What can we get your advice? And they would come back saying, oh, actually, we're interested as well. And it sort of spiraled from there. But then you sort of enter the sales process, and that's an incredibly long, long, long process.
So you sold in 2021.
So we sold, let me kind of get my numbers right here. We sold at the end of 2021, yes. And we started the chats in that start of that year. So it was an 11-month process to kind of go from sort of initial chats to signing the papers.
So you've successfully sold the business. Money pour into your bank account. And now you have to think, what am I going to do next? So what happened then?
Well, I had to do a 2-year earn out. So I worked for the company that bought us for 2 years. And it was during this, and it was quite a restricted earn out. So we weren't allowed to we've always been quite entrepreneurial. We weren't allowed to start other things during that process because, you know, they wanted us to focus on the business, which was fair enough. And so about 18 months into the earnouts, I was very bored, incredibly, incredibly bored, because not only was I still doing the same sales thing, the responsibility of running, because I wasn't running the business by that point, like it was very much part of this group. So Chris and I started doing our content in that second year, which is why we sort of kicked that all off. I think we'll come on to that. And then finished that final year. And then my new business partner is actually an old school friend who's run a very successful software company for 10 years. He exited that same year as me. And I felt like I had one more. I told myself I'd take 6 months off and all of that. That obviously kind of just didn't happen in the end. But basically, I felt like I had one more big business left in me. And for me, there were two sectors that held real appeal. One was in healthcare tech and the other was in green tech. And for me, I think green tech just appealed a little bit more. And so that's what the nugget that Gaia was born from.
And so tell us about Gaia.
Yeah, of course. So Gaia essentially is a SaaS-based business. And we're a tech company that build out products in the green space. And the idea behind it is there's more and more regulation happening across the world in regards to climate, green, and the environment space. And whether, you know, and for me, it's such a fascinating space because it's sort of political meets commercial meets environment meets science. Like there's a whole sort of melting pot of, I don't have to tell you, I think you've been in some of those discussions. And for me, like it kind of misses two things. One is whether you believe the science or not, it is easily one of the most exciting and forward thinking spaces. So there's commercial opportunity there anyway. And second, I've always been one who kind of gets off on identifying what's exactly happening and having those tough chats, and you know, a lot of my content sort of born off that, and so that sort of appealed to me in a lot of ways as well. And so basically what it is when regulation gets rolled out, Guy will read that regulation and we'll build out products that allow companies and corporations to kind of more easily abide by those regulations. So we're quite strict. When this isn't about making them dodgy, because that's not what we believe at all, but it's about recognizing that any regulation includes a disruption and building out products allow it. So a great example is the new BNG scheme that's come out here in England, where if you're in construction at all, you require an uplift of 10% for your of biodiversity, and an idea to kind of help get the English biodiversity in a little bit more ship shape, I think we can say. And so basically what we've done is we've built a marketplace that allows you to list and sell and buy and trade those BNG assets. So it's just things like that kind of helping the regulation move along, making capitalizing on the commercial opportunity, but actually helping in theory move the sort of environment and climate chats forward as well.
And how's that going, Ben? What stage are you at with that business now?
Really good. So we've got two main products. We've got a fledgling team. We've got our offices in Covent Garden. We've got a fledgling team. We've got two main products. We have carbon accounting software and we've got our BNG and natural asset marketplace. We've been really lucky. You know, the product's all built. We're sort of billing across both of them. We're very close to sort of achieving profitability. We should hopefully have that in the next couple of months. And then, you know, I'm a big believer in not taking funding. Like a really big believer in it, if I'm being honest. I always think it should be a last resort. I've seen so many entrepreneurs shafted by, there's a lot of well-meaning capital out there, but there's some real sharks and some of the stories around clawback equity. And like when people say, oh, should I take funding? I always say, but like, what are you going to use that funding for? Because if it's just to accelerate a growth plan that you probably would achieve yourself in 2 years if you just bootstrap it, I'm all for like putting in the elbow grease early on, because the benefit you get long term is so much more. And then if we are ever in a position to raise, we raise when we're doing several million revenue, highly profitable. That suddenly is a much more powerful meeting than you're sort of pitching off a deck and an idea and a hope and a prayer, basically. So I'm a big believer in bootstrapping where you can.
So let's now go to content, because I know that you've done an amazing job. YouTube, newsletters, literally hundreds of thousands of followers and across your platform. So talk to us about the genesis of that, why you decided to do what you're doing.
So it started off by recognizing that personal brand is a huge part of being an entrepreneur now. I think the recognition that if you have a following and a profile, it makes all of your entrepreneurial efforts a hell of a lot easier. So that's kind of where it started. That's why we started filming content. The other part was because we weren't allowed to do anything else and we were a little bit bored. So we started filming ourselves early on. And if you ever saw my early stuff, it's absolute terrible. It's all the sort of rubbish, sort of, you know, just absolute nonsense. But it started sort of progressing quite quickly. And the main reason it started to progress was we started off by just seeing so much nonsense business advice out there. Just really, 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 as not just sort of, I disagree with you, just if you took that advice, I genuinely think you'd run into real issues if you ran your business. So we started off just like, I just was responding to those clips. So I'd, you know, react to them saying, no, you don't want to be doing that. Like, please don't do this. Like, I actually made that mistake. Definitely don't. And it starts off like that. And then one time someone just shared me a recruitment story that they'd just gone through. And I think it was off the back of me talking about an entrepreneur was talking about how to recruit or something like that. And I thought, well, that's a mad story. I'm going to read that out. And it absolutely blew up. And I thought, oh, okay, that's quite interesting. And then because I started doing that, more people started sharing stories. And then it sort of morphed from like terrible recruitment stories into like bad boss stories. And yeah, off the back of that, I just, you know, sort of tapped into something. I think a slight feeling of, you know, lack of motivation perhaps across the world in regards to work. And yeah, I was very fortunate that it just all sort of blew up from there. And yes, like you said, it's been a bit of a journey. It's been I think that's the thing that's blown my mind more, is the amount of views that you get and the power of social media in that sense is, yeah, slightly ridiculous.
And so how does the economics of that work? Because people listening to this will think, oh, I can understand the digital agency and you make websites and then you offer all these services around the web and social media companies. And then people will understand Gaia and they'll understand O-Energy and Green. So how does it work if you have a content platform?
Yeah, of course. So there's sort of three or four ways you can kind of monetize that. One is actually through the content itself. So YouTube, Facebook, TikTok will pay you revenue based on views. So straight away, you've got an earning line there. The second is brand partnerships. So I'm in the B2B space, which is quite a popular space. So companies will, and you know, I get asked a lot. I think it's because there's an association with people liking my channel and sort of thinking if they can be associated with that, then it works for them. So I'm very selective of who I partner with, but I do partner with brands who I basically, if it's something I use with my businesses, I'm very happy to partner with them. That's kind of the rule I have with myself. So I will, you know, promote sort of brands like that, and you get there. I get a lot of sort of speaking gigs, sort of paid to do sort of things like that. I've got a book deal coming off the back later this year. I've got sort of things like a management course coming out and things like that to kind of help support sort of some more products as well. So there's multiple ways you can kind of monetize it. And yeah, like I said, I'm very fortunate because I tapped into something I didn't think I would ever sort of get involved with. And I'm very lucky. I believe quite strongly in my content. I think the challenge a lot of content creators have is they don't believe their own content, but they're kind of trapped by the algorithm. They have to keep saying what their audience wants them to say. And I think that's definitely a downside to social. But yeah, it's a very, you know, I'm very fortunate to be in the position that I am from a monetary perspective, for sure.
And what gives you the greatest joy?
Do you know what? I think it's the stories of, because I get a lot of like, this is my bad boss, but I think it's the stories I get and the messages I get where people said, I actually didn't realize how bad it was until I saw your story. I've since left, I've started my own company. And I get recognized quite a lot in the streets now, which is a very disconcerting experience. But, you know, I was playing hockey the other day and someone on the opposition came up to me and said, oh, you know, I follow your content, just let you know, since I saw that 6 months ago, I've started my own business. I'm doing, you know, so the idea that there are entrepreneurs out there because they recognize how terrible where they're working for, decided to change things up. So that those are the ones that really sort of, you know, pull on the heartstrings, because that just feels great, because that's everyone feels like a winner at that point.
So what's next for you, Ben?
Yeah, good question. I'm getting more involved in sort of like, you know, I'm being invited on a lot of radio shows like LBC and stuff, which I'm enjoying immensely. So I like the debates of what's going on. I think for me, everyone confuses me with like a career expert, an HR expert. And I always say, look, that's not what I am. I just happen to believe that if you want a successful company, the best thing you can do is motivate your team and get, and everyone agrees with me. That's why I always say my content's so idiotic in so many ways, because I don't think anyone disagrees with me. When I say, I'm just saying the bleeding obvious, which is, if I give you the choice between a motivated team or an unmotivated one, like, you're not really going to tell me that. It's a very sort of odd position to be in. But for me, my priority is very, very much Gaia, to kind of keep growing that, try and make it a success, and see where we go there. Because I think it's an exciting time for the next 2-3 years. And then alongside that, just to keep kind of growing my content. I do enjoy it. I've got a few like new TV ideas, for new show ideas that I'll be doing soon, which is quite exciting. I have my book coming out later this year. So there's lots happening. But the honest truth is, because it's all happened so quickly, I don't have a sort of long-term goal on the content side of things, which is interesting.
And I'm going to finish with the question that I suspect everybody asks you. What advice would you give to people starting out on their careers?
Good question. So I think the first thing is, the most important thing about your career is who you're working with, basically. I think having a good boss sets you, I think it sets you forward 4 or 5 years in your career. If you have someone who really takes training seriously, looks after you, I think it absolutely supercharges your career. I think don't be afraid to swap careers. I think we are in a day and age where, like, because statistically it's so, the way, and this one place I will criticize perhaps school and university, because I don't like to do that, because I think they have an impossible job in so many ways. But the one thing I do think people, they perhaps get wrong, is like career advice. And what I mean by that is, it's very much like, everyone knows you can be a lawyer or a doctor or a teacher, but I think there's so much out there that you just don't even have an awareness of it as a thing. And so I always say, don't be afraid to swap careers. Like, it's not quit. I like the word quitting, I think, sometimes quite unhelpful. Like, it can be an incredibly brave thing to do. So like, make that call. You know, me doing Verb was a brave call, because I had a career that I could have been very good at if I'd gone down that route. So don't be afraid to mix up and like change. That's kind of what your 20s are for. Don't let anyone tell you that you can't mix it up. Give something a go. Don't be afraid to like commit your additional time in your week to starting a side hustle. I don't like the phrase, but I think it's a really good thing. Like, exploring how you might be able to monetize the other side of it. Like, having that second income is always useful anyway. But on top of that, you might develop into something you really, really love. But most of all, just, do you enjoy it? Are you happy 80% of your time? Is a really good barometer as to whether you actually are in the right place. Because no job's perfect, right? You're going to have a bad week, you're going to have a bad day. But like, as a core, when you look at 6 to 8 months, you should be enjoying it most of the time. And you really should. It's a myth, I think, to say everyone hates their job, or everyone. And I think we all grew up in, and I think my parents' generation in particular, you know, it was very much, they had horrible bosses as well, but it was a bit more like grit. You had to bear it. But you have more options now. The online, the digital, it's much easier to set up a business or to try new things or work remotely or go, you know, go digital nomad for a couple of years and travel and work. Like, you have all these options. So absolutely, like, utilize it. And you should be enjoying yourself more than perhaps you think.
That's great advice, Ben. Ben, it's been a pleasure talking to you,
Oh,
and
thanks for having me on.
what a fantastic journey you've had. Setting up now numerous successful businesses, all you're doing with your content. I have got no doubt that listening to you, lots of people will have been inspired to think about their own careers and think about what they want to get from their working life. So thank you for sharing all of that.
Oh, thanks so much for having me on. Really appreciate it.
To listen to more episodes and find out how to get happy in your working life, head to workall.co. Work happier.